Again, my name is Samantha Olds-Fry, and I'm the Executive Director of the Illinois Association of Medicaid Health Plans. To give you a little bit of background about the association, we are roughly 2.5, nearly 3 years old, and we represent the 11 health plans that serve the Medicaid space in the state of Illinois. While you'll see names up here that focus on the commercial side as well, as an association, we solely handle the public side and specifically the Medicaid program. You might be asking yourselves why these 11 organizations are particularly impassioned and focused on mental health. And really the reason is not only the moral and ethical motivation to improve a mental health system that is failing millions of people nationwide, but the finances behind it. As Heather pointed out, it's really a simple calculation. Treatment in the community along with supportive housing costs roughly $20,000 a year. Nursing home care costs $31,000 and hospitalizations actually have a little higher number, $6,000 to $8,000 per episode. The thing that you have to remember too is it's not like it's $31,000 versus $20,000. It's $31,000 with a couple hospitalizations in there. And so really the idea of treating in the community, stabilizing and improving somebody's life, is something that not only is the right thing to do morally and ethically, but financially, it makes incredible sense. And so that's really why we're here today, is that this really meets all of the goals of Medicaid care coordination. And in terms of just briefly on why housing is so important as a component of this conversation, is you wouldn't expect somebody who has diabetes to manage their care without housing. And really, at the end of the day, mental illness is a chronic disease, no different than diabetes or chronic asthma or really even cancers at times. For those of you who don't know where Medicaid managed care is within the state of Illinois, all of the filled-in counties, the different various colors, that is where we're talking about. So the large population centers of the state. So we have Cook County and the Collar Counties, the Rockford Region, Central Illinois, the Quad Cities, and Metro East. In terms of managed care or care coordination, that's where you're going to tend to see the most viability for programs like this, because there is both the population base and the provider base to coordinate care. When you get into some of those more rural counties, you have one hospital, one provider, and the idea of coordination is going to be a little bit more challenging, and you also don't have the people to support the infrastructure. In terms of care coordination, we're talking about a large amount of care coordinators and staff to really help people navigate the system. Well, if you have a county that only has a couple hundred Medicaid clients countywide, it doesn't necessarily financially make this sense for the state to invest in care coordination. We in the state of Illinois really serve four different populations, just to give you an idea. We serve seniors and people with disabilities who are not eligible, that's supposed to say, for Medicare. And that's through our integrated care program, the Medicare Medicaid Alignment Initiative. And so that's for individuals that are dually eligible individuals. This is a really expensive group we talk about a lot nationally. And these are individuals enrolled in Medicaid and Medicare. We have our newly eligible adults, which are under the ACA population. What's really interesting about this population is because of how long they've sort of been outside of the healthcare system. We actually, when we look at this population, their healthcare needs look much more like the seniors and people with disabilities than the needs of our, what we would expect them to look more like, which is our family health plan population, which are parents and children. Because they've been left out of the system and they haven't had access to healthcare, their diseases and their issues have become more chronic. And so they're more costly and they're have a larger negative impact on their lives and the quality of life. To give you an idea of the benefits of care coordination, it's an increased focus on the member. A lot of times in healthcare, we talk about providers and we talk about the state or the payer and insurance companies, but we rarely find ourselves actually talking about the people being served, and that is the goal of care coordination. increased coordination of medical benefits. In the state of Illinois and actually nationwide, what you see is for some reason mental health is treated differently than healthcare. However, if you really want to reform healthcare and you want to find a way to increase savings, you're never going to find a way to increase savings or adversely decrease costs without investing in mental health. However, where those savings are actually on the acute healthcare side. So you invest in the mental health system and you drive down costs in hospitals and nursing home care. However, if those are sectioned off into acute health care and mental health care, you're never going to convince the payer for the acute side to invest in mental health, and you're never going to convince the payer for the mental health side to invest either, because the savings are in other buckets. Increased oversight of the Medicaid program. A lot of people don't know this, but individuals enrolled in Medicaid managed care organizations actually have more rights, and there's more transparency than if they were enrolled in fee-for-service. One thing that Heather talked about a little bit was the parity law. The federal parity law applies to Medicaid MCOs. It does not apply to Medicaid fee-for-service. So if you're enrolled in Blue Cross Blue Shield Medicaid, you are protected by the federal parity law. If you're enrolled in general Medicaid, you're not. And it goes further than that as well in terms of timeliness of appeals and claims payment and quite a bit, but that is something that is often overlooked. Timely payments and predictability, this is another finance thing from the state perspective. Modernization of the Medicaid program, and Heather talked about that a little bit, which is really just innovation on how we look at healthcare that isn't really able to happen in state government. And part of that is by design and how government was designed, which is to be a slow process. The democratic process slows things down, and that is at times for our protection as taxpayers and as citizens. However, when it comes to healthcare, we don't have time for a slow, methodical process that involves politics and not necessarily the needs of the people people we should be serving. Decrease costs and increase quality. This is why you've seen the move to care coordination nationwide, is really the idea that you can get more for your limited dollar. I also want to just touch briefly on why mental health treatment is public health, which I feel like mental health and public health are often sort of excluded, and we look at other chronic diseases. But there are some things here that I think really show that it's really not much different than, say, diabetes or asthma in terms of the impact we have on our general population. First, 1 in 5 adults in America experience mental illness. This is far more common than some of the diseases you hear about constantly. However, the stigma keeps a lot of those people and those conversations in the closet. Only 41% of individuals impacted by mental illness receive treatment, which is just astounding. And what really, at the end of the day, that means is our healthcare system is having much higher costs and lower outcomes because we're excluding people from care either through stigma or through access. Individuals suffering from a severe mental illness die on average 25 years earlier than the general population. And again, as Heather said, this isn't because of the mental illness itself, but because they aren't treating other chronic diseases. And this is the last and most shocking to me, which is that suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. And I actually want to think about suicide a little bit differently, and almost change the way we talk about suicide. When we say suicide, it sounds like it is an act and there is a choice. And when for somebody suffering from severe depression or severe mental illness, that simply isn't the case. And so I always think of suicide as dying from depression, which really changes the dynamic and how we look at it. There is no choice involved, just like when you die from cancer, is a death from depression. And that causes, there are only 9 other causes of death that are higher than death from depression. And also, on one last note that isn't on this slide that Heather mentioned, which is that the idea that the horrific crimes and mass shootings have brought a light on to mental health and mental illness nationwide. Well, I'm very thankful for that attention. I worry that it perpetuates a stigma that shouldn't exist, but does, and that is that individuals with mental illness are unsafe, that they're dangerous, and they're going to cause harm to society, when in fact, all of our data suggests that they're more likely to be victims of crime than to perpetuate it themselves or to perpetuate a violent crime. You know, they'll absolutely have crimes of survival because they're trying to survive, but they're not as likely as somebody who's not suffering from a mental illness to perpetuate a violent crime. So mental health and care coordination have a lot of opportunities. Medicaid managed care health plans recognize what Heather's organization and others like them are so valuable and crucial to improving the mental health access and treatment in Illinois and nationwide. And here are some of them. First is that we recognize that mental health is in fact healthcare. We don't view it as the state does, which it budgets for Medicaid in one bucket out of the Department of Healthcare and Family Services and mental health out of the Department of Human Services. And at times, we will hear conversations like mental health isn't Medicaid, that those dollars aren't Medicaid because they're not in the Medicaid agency. From all of my health plans' perspective, they don't know what they're talking about. Like, it's in the rate, it's in the package, it is part of the care that we need to provide to these members. It's all the same thing. It's Medicaid to us. And that is something, it's Medicaid and it's healthcare. And that's something that is always an interesting conversation in Springfield. Financially responsible for the negative impacts. By budgeting and having mental health separate, you can cut mental health lines and you can sort of pretend that that's a savings. You can cut access, you can cut psychiatry rates and access by $30 million and sort of pretend that you saved $30 million. A health plan can't do that because it's all in one bucket. And they'll say, yes, I reduced one cost by $30 million and I increased one cost by, say, $60, $70 million. Like, that's not a benefit and that's not a savvy financial decision a health plan is going to make. I believe that health plans are run by people that do really care about this population, Medicaid, this, and I know that I am probably in a smaller pool. However, I know that most people will agree that insurance companies are probably financially pretty darn savvy. And so at the very least, we can say that they recognize financially why this is an important move. Innovation on small and large scales are possible. The government doesn't really do small innovations to see what works, and at times evidence-based practices are sort of ignored in the sphere of politics. I often find that when talking about evidence-based practices, they are overlooked by things that sort of we think should work. You know, we understand this very simple approach, and so we think that should work, so let's do that because it has a flashier fact sheet and it makes sense and I can fit it into my head in terms, you know, somebody who's not an expert on all of this. A flashy fact sheet does not impress a care coordination organization. They want data, they want evidence-based, and they're willing to try that on a small or larger scale. Health plans that started working with Threshold and some really innovative models started off with serving 50 people. The state of Illinois can't have a project that serves 50 people and see if it works. And then from that 50, it grows. The state of Illinois really does have, and most states and federal government, a one-size-fits-all approach. And that really leads into my next point, which is an ability to create individual care plans. We have and make exceptions for individuals, and we create a care plan, and we create services that aren't offered to other people just for that person. We have somebody, one health plan has had somebody who's visited an ER 72 times in 60 days. 72 times, 60 days. That is the quality of life of this person, I can't imagine. The cost of this person, and not only is it expensive, but we're not getting anything out of it. You know, like, it's one thing to spend a ton of money and improve somebody's life and save their life and really ensure that they go on to live a productive, fruitful, happy existence. But that's not happening with somebody who's going to an emergency room 72 times in a two-month period. For cases like that, health plans really can do a deep dive and say, what does this person need? Let's find this person. Let's get them housing. Let's get them stabilized and put a really intensive care team around this person that we may not be able to do for everybody that we serve. But not everyone we serve needs that intensity. And we have the ability to do that in a way that the state simply does not and that the federal government simply does not. Ability to invest in non-traditional services. This goes from home improvements to housing to transportation. Not on mental health, but generally, a big way that health plans started addressing asthma cases in the city of Chicago was we got window units for our members. This isn't like rocket science or particularly expensive, but that was a way to better serve these people. We got food or increased food services for our elderly population. We had a lot of members who were hoarding. And so we worked with the city to, like, at times just clear out their homes so they could continue to live there. And when it comes to mental health, really looking at housing and additional services on that front. And those are things the state can't do. You know, we have more flexibility. We have the ability to say we're just going to drive these extra benefits to the people who really need them. Could the state afford window units for every single Medicaid client? Probably not. Does every Medicaid client necessarily need a window unit? No. And so we have that flexibility that the state doesn't. However, I don't want you to think that I have fully, while I have drank the Kool-Aid, clearly as I represent Medicaid health plans, I'm not trying to say that we've created a utopia. We are talking about a healthcare system in the United States of America. A utopia does not exist, nor will it exist then probably in my lifetime. So there still are challenges. The first is all the benefits mean that we don't have a standardized approach to healthcare. Not everyone does it the same way. We don't treat everybody the same way. And that is both a pro and a con. And it also does lead, potentially, to people and providers falling through the cracks. There are providers that are really savvy and figured out how to work within the care coordination system. Providers like Thresholds, who have done amazing things and really starting to thrive in the system. There are other high-quality providers that have been historically community-based and small and aren't familiar with billing healthcare systems, and they're not thriving. And we recognize that, and a part of it is there's not a standardized approach. Blue Cross does it different than Aetna, that does it different than Cigna, does it different than Humana, and on the road, you know, like on down the line. And that creates a challenge for sure. A lack of familiarity and trust between health plans and providers. There is a great opportunity to invest in new innovative models of care to really change how the mental health care space looks. However, that takes trust, and that takes familiarity, and that takes communication that we don't have yet today. And that takes time to develop, and that's a true challenge. You can't get to just focusing on the member if nobody talking at the negotiation table believes what the other one's saying. New requirements and regulations surrounding payment and treatment. Payment is not the only component of mental health treatment by any stretch, but it sure is an important one. You're not going to provide treatment if you can't cover your costs. You know, you're not going to be able to employ 10 psychiatrists if we pay you to employ one. It's really just the simple foundation, much like tax policy is the foundation of all public policy. Payment, unfortunately, becomes the foundation of all healthcare policy. If you don't know how to bill and how to be paid for the services you are providing, that foundation is going to wither away below you. And that gets the same thing, it's just a new process for payment. So not only do you have to do certain things for payment, but you have to send in your claims in a different way, and you're dealing with different organizations that are not standardized, that went from 1 to 11, and that creates a challenge. And finally, and on the backdrop of that is, of course, our current landscape, which is a fiscal crisis. You know, we're not innovating when there's extra money, which is actually when they say you should innovate. Innovate when you can lose money and when there's enough money to keep things afloat and keep things afloat while you change, and then slowly take away this, you know, the old supports when somebody is really ready to transition to a new system. We don't have any money, and we are sort of slowly squeezing our community-based providers from both the left and the right. You know, we are transitioning to a new system, and we're taking away any of previous supports during that transition. And what that really leads to is that some providers in 6 months, in a year, in 2 years won't exist. And that is an issue because of my next point. Overall access concerns in the mental health system. There are 70 children psychiatrists in the state of Illinois. One in two children throughout their life or throughout their childhood will have a mental health episode. 70 psychiatrists, one out of two children. It just doesn't add up. And health plans can't fix that, and providers can't fix that overnight. And it is a lot that happened in a system at one point in time. This slide's really depressing, but now we can move to the next one. So while it is really depressing, we cannot let this change pass us by. Transitions offer challenges and a true opportunity for transformation. I believe and subscribe to the concept that you can't ever waste a good challenge or a good problem. That you really, once things are so awful and so atrocious, the fear of change in humanity, that is a natural fear that we all have, of like, let me just keep my status quo, it leaves. You know, once things are horrendous, you're willing to say, well, let me at least try something else. Like, it can't be any worse than this because I'm gonna cease to exist in 6 months if I stick with this, so maybe I'll at least be open to the idea of change when 6 months ago I wasn't. 6 months ago I may have been bashing the Medicaid and health plans, but now I realize they're the only ones paying me and I might as well at least see if it's going to work. That is an opportunity. Historically, mental health reform has been around the edges. We haven't had that comprehensive look at what are we doing, what works and what doesn't. You know, some of the programs we have are politically motivated, and not that there's anything wrong with politically motivated actions, but when you only have a small pool of money and you're wasting it and you are leaving people without treatment, I start to have a problem with those programs. And while I don't want any funds to walk away from the mental health system because we can't afford it, I do want to make sure we're using every single dollar as effectively as possible. And I can tell you that health plans don't care that much about the political motivations of providers or what providers donate to what campaigns or anything. We just want to treat our members. Like, we don't run for election. And that is nice in a state like Illinois. We know the fee-for-service system is failing people, providers, and the state. It just isn't working. It's broken. It hasn't worked, and it's been broken for quite some time. And because of the massive amount of chaos, people are finally willing to really admit that and think, how do we move from here in a way that isn't just around the edges? And as Heather said, we have to focus on prevention and the entire spectrum of care necessary to serve Illinoisans. I was on the budget staff. I did this every year. You look and you have to save money, and where you go is sort of those who need it the least, those not in crisis. Yes, I know when you serve somebody about to be in crisis or keep somebody out of crisis in the long run, you save money. But you save money on a different budget year, and I don't have to budget, and I don't have to balance that budget year to balance this one. And I just need my lines to add up. I just need that bill to add. We have like three rules on staff. The third was add the bill. That's all I needed. And you can do that. And by cutting things like prevention and moderate levels of care, because it's 1 year, it's one piece of paper, which healthcare just doesn't fit into. We're not, this isn't a system on a piece of paper, it's not a single year, and health plans look at it in a different way than that, thankfully. I think that is.
Thank you very much. Oh, geez, did they tape this mic here? Because if I could pull this mic off, then I could just pass it to you, and people don't have to keep getting up to answer questions. Somebody thought.
For Jack. Yeah, for small enough
words. We can all just yell at you, and you're good with that? Oh, okay.
They're used
to it. All right, okay. Well, I'll use the mic. Anyway, let me ask a couple of preliminary questions, take advantage of being the chair of the event, and then we'll open it up to folks. One, could you just give us a quick overview of Illinois mental health care finances? Because those of us from others, I mean, just you have a Republican governor, Democratic governor, up or down the last few years, because we're all coming from different states. And so just a quick orientation as to Illinois' trajectory.
Yeah, so that's actually a great question, and I was going to address it, but I forgot.
Sure.
So basically, in Illinois, Medicaid is sort of funded out of two buckets. One is the Medicaid bucket. That is the primary funding source in Illinois. And the other bucket is through state general revenue funds, so it's grant-based. And because Medicaid rates and the services it provides fall really short, the grant funds, a lot of times, make up the difference for Medicaid rates and also cover services that Medicaid will never be able to cover, like supportive housing. And mental health, obviously, has never really been funded very strongly in Illinois. And we had over $100 million in cuts between FY 09 and FY 11, which is hugely significant. It was over $113 million in cuts, and we looked at what happened with psychiatric hospitalizations during that same period of time as people lost services. Psychiatric hospitalizations spiked by 19%, costing about $131 million. So what Sam alludes to is that prevention is easy to cut, treatment, and it doesn't necessarily impact that budget year, but the data really, really strongly shows that when people don't have treatment, costs go up. But so that, I hope, in a nutshell, is where the funding comes from.
Well, and also just the trajectory, because, like, okay, just California, where I'm from, we got clobbered, you know, from 09 to 12, basically, off the recession and everything. But it sort of stabilized, and now there's some incremental refunding of some programs over the last 2 or 3 years. I don't know where Illinois is at, sort of on that trajectory.
We're not there even a little bit.
Okay.
We, at one point as a state, recognized we were getting clobbered. It was a recession. Lost a lot of revenue when we raised taxes. It wasn't necessarily popular, but it stabilized the program for a little bit. The problem is that we made a political decision to have that tax increase sunset. They were just going to get back on track and then it'll go away. We didn't calculate that potentially we would have, in Illinois, we have a Democratic legislature with supermajorities. We're fairly Democratic state for the most part. And we overlooked the idea that we could elect a Republican governor. We elected a Republican governor that asked us not to extend the tax increase. The Democratic legislature obliged, did not extend the tax increase, and as we talk right now, we have about $7 billion in unpaid bills. We're operating the state off of consent decrees. We don't have a budget. We were supposed to have a budget by July 1st. This is the longest in state history. We haven't had a budget. And where you're really seeing the cuts, 90% of the state budget is covered by consent decrees. Medicaid is one of those. It falls into that 90%. The other 10% is not funded at all. That 10% is all of those GRF payments and supportive housing, homeless support, Meals on Wheels, all these other programs that really support the healthcare system. A big chunk of mental health funding falls into that 10%. Because that's not being paid right now, and because even though we don't have a budget, we're actually spending at least our current revenue, if not above our current revenue, through our the court orders and consent decrees. So essentially, we're at a place where either we ignore all of higher ed and all of our community-based services that don't, you know, fall into a court order,
goes off.
Yeah, and just to, so this year is extremely and very saddening to me in what's happening, that we don't have a budget. And what Sam alluded to is that, you know, because we have so many different consent decrees around Medicaid, mental health, other disabilities, a lot of those services are being paid. But I also want to go back to after we had the $113 million in cuts, mental health funding did go up about $68 million for a couple of years. But almost all of that funding went to consent decree funding, so basically deinstitutionalizing people over those civil rights lawsuits that I mentioned. And just to give you a snapshot of what that means, that is just a sliver of the population with serious mental illnesses. Threshold is, as I believe, is the largest mental health provider, community-based mental health provider in the state. We serve over 7,000 people. We had about 500, probably a little bit more than 500 consent decree members in Threshold that we are supporting in the community. So while it's really critically important to deinstitutionalize people who shouldn't be in those settings, it's not doing anything to prevent people from the trajectory of institutionalization. And I think oftentimes that's missed because people just don't understand what the consent decrees do and what a small portion of the population it is. And so there are many, many other consent decrees now that are very old that are coming into play to force states to pay providers under those consent decrees. But with respect to increased funding, we are not, we haven't made up for the losses over the last several years, and we haven't even begun to really build an adequate
mechanism. While costs are increasing.
Yeah.
Right, okay, now Hogg, one more question, and I'm sorry, and then you all can have the questions. Okay, I remember in California in 91, we were dealing with the real estate bust when the state budget crashed, and all of a sudden we were short a lot of money, and so mental health immediately gets pulled up as, well, let's see what we can do to slash that. And so we came up with some kind of devolution thing where it went to all the counties, basically. The state gave up and took all the hospital money and everything else, sent it down to the county levels. And the argument at the time was, because, well, how do we know the county? What the counties are going to do with it? All these boards of supervisors can have all their pet projects. We don't know that it's going to get to mental health care. So they said, oh, that's all right. We'll have all these accountability standards, and you'll know. And we said, well, what are those standards? And, well, we'll figure that out later. And so that kept getting pushed forward, like from 94 to 95. And somewhere in the late 90s, they just kind of gave up on accountability standards. The money was just gone. And we never did find out what happened in terms of care. So, you know, listening to Sam's discussion about, you know, okay, now we're going to give it to Humana and everybody, and they'll do better. The question is, how would we know?
So the nice thing is that, in this example, insurance companies are not nearly as popular as counties. Nobody has any qualms about holding an insurance company responsible the way that, you know, a local elected official would not like to hold their county officials as responsible as potentially they should be. You're regulated federally, and by two state agencies, the Department of Insurance and the Department of Health Care and Family Services, hold the very strict standards in terms of contracts, and overall have what is called a medical loss ratio, which means we turn in every claim we pay, every dollar we spend, and we say, okay, this was what we spent on administrative expenses, and this is what we spent on healthcare. Depending on our contract, we have an 88 to 85% medical loss ratio. So for our seniors and people with disabilities, we should spend 88 cents out of every dollar we receive on healthcare. What is interesting about that is what we consider healthcare, and probably in our minds, is actually very different than what the state says is healthcare. So if we invest in quality, and we say we'll pay a quality bonus, or we will create a data system that will assist in improving quality healthcare. That is considered administrative. That's not healthcare. That's just improving healthcare. That's
admins are here for their salary. You know, that is a licensed clinical social worker or an RN going to people's homes, reminding them of appointments, showing them how to take their medication, helping them fill out applications for SNAP, which are food benefits. That is, that, the salary, is health care. Their retirement, their own health care, their taxes that we have to pay the employer is all admin. So it's a really narrow definition, and the state has no problem holding us accountable for that. Quality has also been, we are measured on quality in a way the state has never been measured on quality, especially a state like Illinois. We are regularly the lowest ranked state in terms of quality of our Medicaid program on a fee-for-service setting. Regularly in the bottom 1 or 2 quartiles or percentiles. It really makes you feel warm and fuzzy when you think of how much we're spending, but that's fine. We are measured on that. Now, there are some issues about measuring mental health quality, or mental health treatment quality. The FES, the HEDIS, and the NCQA, and all these different organizations that really focused on acute health care for a really long time. Because that's been what the payers focused on, and that was easy to understand, and that was a focus. And there hasn't been a focus on mental health or substance use disorder treatment from the accountability organizations in terms of quality. They're now starting to look at that, but we don't have great metrics across the board. You know, one of the big metrics we have is, do you get a follow-up visit after a behavioral health hospitalization within 14 days? Yes or no? You're a poor quality plan if it's a no, and you're a high quality plan if it's a yes. Doesn't talk about what happened after that one follow-up visit. Doesn't talk about where you prescribe medications and if you take them, or you know, it doesn't capture the nuance of healthcare. It's just a yes or a no that you get the visit.
And I also think too that, you know, even though the state is in chronic fiscal crisis, state still has far more resources than counties, and we need a statewide, thoughtful approach to mental health treatment. I mean, it affects so many aspects of the state budget, Department of Corrections, Medicaid. I mean, Medicaid is over a $15 billion program, and Medicaid really is the primary funder. So I think it's important to sort of have a broad state policy rather than having it splintered in different approaches at the county. And I also think there's probably more potential for political influence when you push it down to the local level. And probably I shouldn't say that out loud, but that is the case. And I do agree that there are quality metrics within managed care. But I still think we have a ways to go in developing, in further developing them. I think that the Medicaid program, I mean, it is a healthcare medical program, and developing quality metrics beyond what are called just the HEDIS measures, which are very focused on a point in time, you know, reducing hospitalizations, making sure you have a follow-up medical visit post-hospitalization at 17 days and 14 days and 30 days. Those are just easy metrics to measure. And quite honestly, Threshold has been contracting at a very generous rate with managed care companies to make sure that they hit those metrics so that they can get their withhold. What managed care companies aren't incentivized to do right now is to pay a rate like they're paying to hit those HEDIS measures for continued treatment. And for somebody who has schizophrenia, continued treatment is almost an absolute must throughout their life. So we need to, that still needs to be revisited, and we need to figure out how to develop, whether it's quality metrics or whatever incentives need to be put in place. You know, and that's just, this is a work in progress. And I think that it requires conversations with managed care and with the state. but I think it's better to have stronger state funding around mental health care than basically excuse state cuts to push it down to local governments that are very strapped as well and simply don't have as many resources available to them as the state.
Well, just to briefly comment on what happened in California then is that, you know, San Francisco County, that's great. You know, they're going to support it, and you know, but then we're like Illinois, you got all these rural counties where there's no constituency, and so of course it goes the other way. So other folks, comments, and if you know, questions, comments based on yours, yes.
For the people you're responsible for. You will get this bonus if you transition people out of nursing homes. You know, Medicaid in Illinois, depending on what you count as Medicaid, which is a whole different story, is $15 to $17 billion to care for 3.2 million people. There is money in the program, which is where it's being allocated. There are some questions. So as long as performance-based metrics are defined and set in a way that ensures you're still driving costs, that is a good way to improve access, because then those community-based organizations that are saving the system money have more resources that they can then reinvest in the care that they're providing. I want to point out to people that I'm a realist, that there's still a tipping point, and that's access to providers. You know, I can throw a ton of money at providers, but if they don't exist, it's just, you know, it's not getting anywhere. Money helps to improve access, but there are only 70 providers statewide. Like, you can only improve access so much, and that's we still have a workforce issue.
Yeah, and I think that, so from Threshold's perspective, we are growing because of management. And we are growing because of creative contracts with some managed care companies that are rewarding pay-for-performance and rewarding outcomes. But that's only a handful of managed care companies. The others, I believe, are still, you know, using the old fee-for-service framework. Even though we have managed care, most providers and most managed care companies contract using the fee-for-service rate and the fee-for-service services. We aren't taking new clients based on those payment arrangements through managed care because we lose money on them. And so I think while we have increased access in pocket, we don't really have broader increased access, in part because of what Sam alluded to. I mean, without an infusion of new money, and it can't just be the managed care companies. I mean, it has to be the state investing in rates that cover costs and including those rate adjustments in the capitation rate that they pay managed care companies, and also incentivizing or encouraging or pushing or however you want to frame it, managed care companies to be innovative, to contract smartly and creatively with providers to allow them to do what we need to do for our clients. And some of that has to do with we need rule revisions around the fee-for-service rules, because what Illinois has done, and I don't think Illinois is unique, is that we just bring managed care in to a system that is terribly underfunded and terribly broken and hamstrings providers and what they can do. And those rules were structured to keep costs down, even though it didn't make sense. That's how they were structured. And I think that's what most states have done. They just bring managed care into the same system. They don't, states, Illinois and others, they don't invest in backup infrastructure so that providers know how to fill 11 different new companies as opposed to the state. They don't educate providers on how to talk to managed care companies, how to contract, and they just don't invest in the infrastructure. I mean, if we have X amount of providers, we're not going to grow capacity. so I think there is increased access in pockets, but there's so much more that we have to do.
Yes, right over there.
Hi, my name is Hannah. I work with Medical Home Network. We have an accountable care organization called the Accountable Care Organization. So I'm wondering.
Are you in this state, just to get oriented?
Chicago.
Okay.
I'm wondering, even within those 11 managed care plans, so plan and contract out for behavioral health services. But then we have kind of like this added entity right that we're working with care coordination.
So not all health plans contract out, and sometimes it's really weird in insurance space. It's health plans that look like they're contracting out own the entity they've contracted out to. For example, Illini Care owns some PACO. So there's still a lot of integration. There are pros and cons. One, you don't want to set up the two buckets. You want to make sure that if you're contracting out, you're holding a behavioral health entity responsible for hospitalization. You're really looking at that. The big pro is the idea of specialization. And the mental health space in terms of the providers, in terms of treatment, is very, very different than what hospitals expect and what nursing homes expect and what PCPs expect. And even within a large insurance company, you have divisions that focus just on hospitals, divisions that focus just on, PCPs. It's still small, but they have that specialization. It does at times create red tape and confusion, and you add more people or sort of more chefs in the kitchen. And it's really about how you structure it, and you can structure it really well, and you can structure it incredibly poorly. What I would recommend in terms of state policy is to never have an overall separate entity solely responsible for behavioral health. You see this in a lot of states. The transition to managed care 10, 15 years ago, they sectioned off behavioral health and they contracted out to a behavioral health managed care organization. Just like you would say with dental providers, and we have states that have just dental covered under something else. And once you section it off, you change the financial dynamic. As long as health plan A, let's say, or county care, or Illini Care, or Aetna, is still overall responsible for the total budget, yes, they may subcontract it out, but they've structured that contract in a way that makes sense and that they should be looking at both hospitalization and behavioral health treatment. And they are because of how the contracts were set up. They could be set up better in terms of quality. There's no disagreement there on how those incentives are set up, but they do exist.
Yeah.
I have another question. If other folks don't, I don't want to cut anybody off here.
I have a question.
Yes.
When you get away from managed care and really to care coordination and through this transition period, the idea is yes. because you look at the whole person, we do risk assessments, we recognize the signs, and we can develop comprehensive treatment. We can work with entities like Thresholds and really develop innovative models of care that sort of recognize everything somebody needs. And it's not rare that somebody needs substance use disorder treatment along with treatment for their schizophrenia, along with treatment for a host of other healthcare issues. That being said, we are a system on top of another system. And as challenging as the mental health system is in Illinois, the substance use disorder treatment system is probably more challenging. And it has been ignored and neglected for even longer than the mental health system. And so right now, I think a lot of providers would say we're just a barrier. They don't know how to bill us, and so they're providing treatment without payment, and that's going to cut access eventually. That's the reality today that they're facing, and so I have a hard time saying that that's not the reality. That's not the goal, that's not the vision, but substance use disorder providers, when they build the state of Illinois, they don't fill out a claim the way that normal or traditional healthcare providers would. And so transitioning to Medicaid managed care really created just some operational challenges. You know, they just plugged in some numbers into a system. It's a very simplistic way to build. It doesn't work like that work across. You can't just say, I saw Susie on, you know, October 5th for 45 minutes of a group therapy session by checking some boxes on the system and saying, yeah, that's right. And most of the system in that requires some claims, and the provider network doesn't have that capability. I mean, especially substance use disorder providers right now. So that is something we are incredibly
concerned about. And I also think, too, that the problem goes back to the rules. We had, in the mental health world, we have a mental health rule. And in the substance use world, there are two substance use rules. We're a mental health provider. We just got a substance use license, but we haven't even been mentioned into that yet. But a lot of our clients have substance use conditions, but we can't bill under the substance use code or whatever it is because we didn't have a substance use license. And then substance use providers, they treat people with substance use issues. Many of them have mental health conditions, but unless they're a mental health provider licensed under the mental health rule, they can't bill under those, you know, for those services. So our system is so fragmented. And when I talk about the need for like rule reform, I mean, we do have a managed care system laid on top of a system that makes no sense at all. So I think that if we reform these rules, invest in providers to help them build the infrastructure to be able to build managed care, I mean, that, you know, those two things are huge undertakings. those need to happen before we have, I think, a stronger, integrated, innovative system around both mental health and substance use, which often comes from the government.
And those rules confuse the health plan immensely. You know, we find high-quality providers that seem very capable of doing these services. So it's not only that you have to be a mental health provider or substance use disorder provider, you have to have been certified to cover certain services. Sometimes they look very, very similar. Or could they could meet those requirements with just a minor investment that we're willing to make. And that they can't. The state doesn't count it as a medical expense if we have a mental health provider not certified for a certain service under the fee-for-service mental health rule, not under any regulatory body, not under just under payment rules, not under anything in terms of patient care, which we would never want to do. I mean, that's the regulatory patient care standards nobody's messing with. But in terms of payment standards, we could not make an exception and say, well, Thresholds is really good at the 9 things they do, we believe they could do this 10th thing that other people are doing. they can go to sleep for that kind of thing. And it just followed the mind with all kinds of CEOs.
Another question before I teach a course in healthcare administration. I always start with fee-for-service as a concept 100 years ago, and I argue that every policy since then has been a patch on the concept of fee-for-service. Mm-hmm. You know, that all the things that don't get covered, all the people don't get covered, every policy in the last 100 years has just been another patch over the fee-for-service system, and that's yeah, which is why it's so inherently dysfunctional. And one last question before I give my lecture. Okay, so what about, you know, you talk about homelessness and affordable housing. Where do the services for helping people find affordable housing come in under this rubric of managed care? Is there anywhere that that happens, or?
It's a topic that is being discussed really vigorously, I think, within the provider and advocacy community, along with the managed care community and state policymakers. I think the managed care companies realize it's something that has to be funded. I think it's an issue of funding source. And then I also think, you know, if we're going to do this in the healthcare arena, it has to be not just, you know, where do we get the dollars, but then who gets the subsidies? Because in an era of extremely limited government funding, you have to be able to demonstrate that it makes fiscal sense to do it. So you have to target the housing. And I believe the easiest solution is funding rental subsidies. We don't have to, we still need to build affordable housing, but we can provide many people with a rental subsidy because the housing stock is there. But the rental subsidies have to be targeted to the most expensive Medicaid beneficiaries. I think if we're going to talk about addressing housing in the healthcare space, it can't be to solve the homeless problem. As much as I would like to do that, it's just not realistic. So I think that the conversations are happening. I also think at the federal level, the CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, recently put out a bulletin on covering some supportive housing services through Medicaid. So while CMS is probably not ever going to cover, you know, the hardcore housing, but they are recognizing that unless we have a solution to housing and supportive services, that we're never going to bring Medicaid costs down. So I think the conversations are happening. I don't think we're in agreement on how to fund it. And I just had a conversation yesterday with some state policymakers about this. And it's challenging, especially in the environment here in Illinois today. But I think we'll get there.
So maybe by the time Sam's child is in high school.
Yes. And to take it back just one step, we're responsible, all our care coordinators are responsible for filling out applications and attempting to get people any services that they need, even those outside of our capitation rate, such as affordable housing. Well, when there's no access to affordable housing, because it's all full for obvious reasons, we're held responsible for it, so we can't meet the needs.
All right. Well, I really appreciate folks sticking around because we got in the weeds here, and a lot of people don't like being in the weeds except, you know, healthcare financing and services and how do you put these things together. But as those of us who have been in the weeds know, if you don't do this, you never get services to anybody anywhere in this country. So you got to learn this stuff. So I really appreciate the patience of people staying, the good questions, and I just can't believe how fortunate we were to have so much of the health, mental health care policy expertise of Illinois in one room at one time. So thank you very much, everybody.